This program is brought to you by Emory University.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Dietrich Stout, the Associate Director of the Center for Mind, Brain, and Culture here, and I see some new faces. If you all are aware of us or aren't aware of us, you should check out our website. You can sign up easily to become an affiliate and get notified of all these sorts of events. In particular, the lunches will let you know, and you can sign up for them. But we also have a bunch of other programming, talks. We do a wide range of things, say small grants, sponsoring courses. We do a lot of things related to this broad area of interdisciplinary approaches to mind, brain, and culture. If you haven't been to our website, please come check it out and sign up to be an affiliate. So it's our real pleasure to be able to welcome Dr. Fiona Cross today to speak about spider cognition. Fiona is coming from the University of Canterbury in Christchurch, New Zealand, via the University of Florida. And as I hope you all were able to attend the talk yesterday, but if you're not, she also spends quite a bit of time in Kenya with the spiders there. It was a fascinating talk yesterday about the approach behaviors of spiders and sort of spatial cognitive and planning kinds of issues, and particularly, how you can get by when you only have a few neurons to rub together. It's a really fascinating question. I think here in the center, it's particularly fascinating because we have a lot of interest in these concepts of embodied and distributed cognition. We're going to have Andy Clark coming by in the spring, if you have heard about that. But you can talk, what is doing the cognition? Is it just the neurons, or, when we start saying there's not that many neurons, how much of it is instantiated in situations and bodies? And sense organs that these animals have. So I don't know if that's a direction that you're going to talk about at all, but I think that's a very interesting reason to think about how you can get complex, intelligent behavior in animals with small nervous systems or no nervous system even, and spiders are a great way to think about that. But maybe that's my bias, and you'll take your thing in some direction. I think it would be nice, I've just been introducing you, but it'd be nice to go around the room if everybody would just say briefly who they are, since we're a small group here.
Yeah, that's great, thank you.
I'm Andy Kazama in psychology, just one floor down.
I'm Brandon Fricker, I'm a graduate student in the psychology department.
Cool.
I'm Donna McDermott, I'm a grad student in PBEE.
Can you say what that is?
Yeah.
It's population biology, ecology, and evolution.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Harold Gazulis, I'm in the psychology department. I teach animal behavior.
Okay, yeah.
My name is Jessica, and I'm a graduate student in the neuroscience program.
Okay.
I'm Connor Morzumi. I'm also in Donna's lab in PBEE, and we're in a lab that mostly studies community ecology of plants and pollinators, so we do some behavioral work in association with that, with bumblebees, and I'm mostly an ecologist, so this is pretty far outside my wheelhouse, but I do think about kind of the choices that bees and other pollinators make and how that influences the community structure and functioning that we look at. So,
yeah.
I'm Todd Morris, faculty at your piece, and sort of in anthropology. I study primate and human brain evolution.
Cool.
Tamara Beck, program coordinator for the CDC.
Okay.
I already introduced myself, so.
Okay.
Take it away.
I'll take it away, yeah. Well, thank you all so much for coming along. I always love sharing spider joy, so it's great to see you here. And, I mean, as has been mentioned, I've lived a pretty different sort of life. I mean, I've been based in Christchurch at the University of Canterbury for a number of years. But just as a very brief aside, I'm originally a New Zealander. I grew up in a place called Tauranga, and I can't resist showing a few photos. So this is my hometown, and Mount Maunganui Beach is about a 10-minute drive from the house where I grew up. But I have had another home, which has been in Kenya. While I've been in Kenya, I've been based in a small town called Mbita. To get there, we arrive in Nairobi, and it takes about 8 or 9 hours to reach Mbita by road. The nearest big city to Mbita is Kisumu, which is about a 2.5-hour drive away. We go grocery shopping there about once a month. And when we're in Mbita, we're based at the International Center of Insect Physiology and Ecology. Very attractive campus. It's situated right on the shore of Lake Victoria. And yeah, Africa's got such stunning scenery. And when you think of Africa, you'll also probably think of the incredible wildlife. It's just amazing going to see these mammals, birds, and reptiles. And here's some primates I've seen over the years. Some people have had the good fortune of being able to work in Kenya, and they get to work in these places like Tsavo East or Amboseli. And they're very lucky people. I mean, we've worked in Kenya for so long, and we don't get to work in places like Tsavo East or Amboseli, because our field sites are very different. We have, as our field sites, walls, and on these walls you just see all the spidery action and adventure. All you really need to do is stare at a wall, and you might be able to start making some discoveries. So yes, although it's true that in Kenya you can find these big amazing predators like hyenas and lions, but I want to argue that there are much smaller predators that are also found there, and we think that they are just as interesting and just as exciting to study. Now, when you think about a spider that would be of the most interest to us in the context of animal cognition, it could be easy to assume that a tarantula would be of the most interest to us, because it's a big spider and therefore it's got a big brain. However, it turns out that a spider that would fit on a person's hand is actually of a lot less interest to us than a spider that would fit on a person's finger. That spider is standing on my finger. I've got small hands. This is a species of jumping spider, and I will be focusing on that particular species in this talk. Jumping spiders, the family Psoptosidae, it's the largest family.
Is it okay to ask questions?
Sure. Yeah.
So a tarantula has to go out and hunt as well.
Right? Yes.
So why is its brain so small relative to its body?
I don't know. Yeah. The thing about jumping spiders, though, is, as I'm about to mention, they are very visual animals. And so, that's part of the reason why they've got an advanced visual system. Yes.
Doesn't that also follow the usual rule of the llama tree that larger animals have relatively small brains?
So jumping spiders, there's over 6,000 different species found throughout the world. Here are some of the spiders that I've seen in New Zealand and in Kenya. And these are a couple of species I've found while I've been in Gainesville. And you can see that there's a range of colours there. I mean, there are some that are so brightly coloured, like the peacock spiders. But no matter where you are in the world, to identify a jumping spider, all you need to do is look at a spider. And if it turns and looks back at you with these two big eyes at the front, then you know that you've found one. And Yeah, they've got such remarkably good eyesight for animals of this size. So they actually, most of them don't build webs for capturing their prey. Instead, they actively hunt for their prey like tiny little cats. So this was actually my cat in Kenya, Rafiki. And so what a jumping spider will do is when it sees its prey, it will start stalking the prey, and it will just be very slow at first, and then at the right moment it will get quicker, and then it will pounce and it will grab, kill and eat its prey. Now they've got 8 eyes. They've got 6 of these smaller eyes called the secondary eyes, and these mainly, just for simplicity, they function as motion detectors. But it's these 2 big eyes at the front called the principal eyes, which are of a lot more interest to us because these are the eyes that enable the spider to see objects in its day-to-day life. But just to get you back to Lake Victoria again, there are 2 species that we've focused on which come from this part of the world. The first one on the left is Evarca culicivora. This is the spider that convinced me to work with spiders in the first place. And the reason why I became so interested in spiders was because it was found that this spider preys by preference on mosquitoes. Now, this was of a lot of personal interest to me because my mum was born in Zambia. And at the age of 2, she nearly died of malaria. And when I heard about the spider, I rather liked the idea of working with something that targets one of our enemies. But so when I began working with spiders, I just wanted to learn more. My background's in psychology. I'm interested in animal cognition. And we have been focusing a lot on Portia africana. This will be the focus of my talk today. It's of a lot of interest to us in the context of animal cognition, and the reason why is because of how it targets other spiders as its preferred prey. There are 17 different species of Portia found in Africa, Asia, and Australia. As I mentioned, I'll focus on Portia africana. Before I do, though, I need to tell you a story. So this is Professor Robert Jackson. He is the person who convinced me to work with spiders in the first place. I have to point out, nothing happened with that baboon that was approaching Robert. After I took that photo, I said, "Robert, there's a baboon." He turned around, wagged his finger at the baboon, and the baboon walked away. That's not the story I meant to tell you. The thing is that it's like way back in, I think it was 1987, Robert and his colleague Stim Wilcox were in the rainforests of Queensland, Australia, and it was a hot day. It was in December, and they had with them a vial containing a different species of Portia, Portia fimbriata. And what they wanted to do was go into this rainforest, find a tree trunk that had a spider web, and then release the Portia and see how the spider makes web signals on a spider's web. Okay, so they were trudging through this rainforest, they had their gear, and then they find a tree trunk with a spider web. They released the Portia underneath the spider web, and then they watched, and the spider was doing things quite slowly. It turned one way, and then another way, and then Robert and Stim watched as Portia turned around and walked away. Now, Robert and Stim looked at each other because their plan had failed that day. It just was not what they were expecting this Portia to do. And they were going, well, what do they do now? You know, it was very hot. Apparently they were being attacked by mosquitoes. And they were thinking, well, do we look for another Porsche? I mean, Porsche's very hard to find. It's a very funny-looking spider. It's when you first see it, it looks like a piece of detritus in a web. And so it wasn't so straightforward for them to just go rushing and looking for the spider that had moved away. And they were beginning to think, well, why don't we just pack up and we'll try this another day, we'll find another Porsche. They were talking about what to do next. And then as they were talking, Robert just glanced up, and above this web, he saw the Porsche that had escaped. And things were happening very slowly. The Porsche moved across a vine above this web, and then it attached a line of silk to the vine, and then very slowly it went down its line of silk until it became even with the occupant of the web, Agiopea pensa. Now, when Porsche became level with the spider, it began swinging on its line of silk, and it gained momentum until it just went into the web, grabbed the spider, and killed and ate the spider in its own web. Now, Robert and Stim just looked at each other. You know, what was the spider drama which had unfolded before their eyes? I mean, Porsche had not even made contact with the web until it had actually grabbed this spider. Now, what Robert and Stim didn't know was that when prey land on Agiope's web, it will just go for its prey. But if it detects that something untoward has entered its web, like a hungry Porsche, it will start shaking its web violently. And Porsche ran a very real risk of being slung away to the forest floor. And yeah, they were thinking, well, I mean, as Porsche was moving around the tree trunk, it couldn't even see the spider for part of the way. And yeah, this was in the late 80s. They were thinking, well, is this something that we could even consider, that these spiders are using cognition to capture their prey? I mean, what's going on? And so they wanted to learn more about this behavior, and then Robert began designing experiments to test for detouring behavior by Porsche. Here, by the way, is Porsche eating a spider. That's the spider that Porsche is eating. I mean, one thing that they did know was that back in the late 70s, David Hill in the US had been learning about detouring behavior by a different jumping spider, Phidippus, which is found in the US. And it's different, though, with Phidippus, because what happens is that Phidippus is generally found in shrubbery, a very three-dimensional environment, and insects will land in these shrubs. Phidippus will go capturing these insects, but generally it doesn't have a straight path to the insect. It first has to go around different parts of the shrub until it gets close enough to capture the prey. So what David Hill did was he created artificial vegetation consisting of a pole and pieces of cardboard. He placed the spider on the cardboard, and one thing to point out with working with jumping spiders is that because they can see so well, what you can do is get, in this case, a dead prey insect, glue it into a lifelike posture onto a piece of cork, and the spider will respond to the lure as though it's living prey. Okay, so while the spider was on this artificial vegetation, it could see the lure. It couldn't reach the lure by leaping. The distance was too far. Really, in order to reach the lure, it needed to be up there. because then it could leap down towards the location of the lure. But to reach that point, it couldn't just simply leap up. It first needed to walk, go up this pole and across there. And by this point, David Hill had removed the lure from the apparatus. But even still, once the spider had reached that point, it still oriented itself in the location of where the lure had been. However, most of the deterring experiments with jumping spiders has been done with Portia. Before I get into the work that we've done, I first want to show you an experiment that it's a different sort of experiment looking at the deterring behavior by Portia. In this case, what these researchers did was that they actually video recorded how Portia oriented itself as it was facing the different components of the apparatus. Okay, so what happened was that the spider began the trial on top of this tower, and from the tower, it could view a lure attached to a pole. Also, while it was on top of the tower, it could view two walkways, but you know, as you can see, one has got a gap in it, and the other one is a complete walkway. And what they found with these video recordings was that at first, the spider oriented to the lure, and it spent a lot of time at first looking at this broken walkway. So it looked from the lure until it reached the gap, then it looked back at the lure, then back at the gap, and then back at the lure. And it was as though it was determining that this was not the way to go. It gradually spent more and more time going, looking at this complete walkway and going back, looking at this lure and looking down, and then going, looking down at the pole attached to this walkway, and then looking up and down and up and down, and then going across to the lure. And once it had looked enough, it then went down from the tower and then across to this pole. Now, at any given time, the lure was visible to the spider. It's a very different sort of experiment to what we have done, because what we want to do is test for planning behavior, which involves Portia not being able to see the lure while it's taking the detour. Here's an example of Portia taking a detour. So here we've got Portia here, and we've got a spitting spider. Now, as you will probably imagine, when it comes to spitting spiders, the back end is the safe end. And what Portia would...
What did they spit, by the way?
It's a sticky gum. It's like, so what they do is when they're preying, like as part of their predatory behavior, they'll spit on their prey, and then the prey is lodged in this gum, and then spitting spider goes and eats it. So, yeah. And so Portia has a very real risk of being stuck. So what Portia does is it will take detours. Even it will walk underneath a leaf so that it can approach the spitting spider from behind. Oh. There has been a lot of detouring behavior that's been done using Portia. I will be describing one of the experiments that has been done. One of the things, though, is that there are other jumping spiders that do eat other spiders, and we were interested in whether this capacity to plan detours is unique to Portia or not. One thing to point out is that, yes, Portia is a jumping spider, but more technically, it is from the Solticid subfamily Spartaceae, and most of the spiders from the subfamily specialize at preying on other spiders. And what we did was we got 15 species from the subfamily. They're from different localities. And we were just interested, do they take detours to reach other spiders? So in this experiment, the spider began the trial on top of this tower. From the tower, it could view lures inside of two boxes. One of the boxes contained dead prey spiders, and in the other box contained just pieces of dead leaf. The spider was motivated to go towards the prey lures. It had actually been kept without prey for a week before being used in these experiments. The thing, though, is that the distance between the tower and the lures was too far for the spiders to reach by leaping. And also, the apparatus was sitting in a pan of water. These spiders will all avoid getting wet if they can help it. So they first needed to walk down from this tower and then go to one of the walkways to reach the lures. So they could either... Oh, actually, what I should point out is that when they reached the bottom of the tower, we completely removed the lures entirely from the apparatus. So from this point onward, the spider couldn't simply turn to see where the prey lures were located. It could either then go along the walkway to reach where the prey lures had been, which we called the correct walkway, or it could go along the other walkway, which we called the incorrect walkway. But importantly, whether the prey were in box A or in box B was determined at random before each trial. So about half the spiders had to go past the incorrect walkway before they could reach the correct walkway. And initially, we were interested in whether the spiders chose the correct walkway just by walking up this first segment. One very important thing I need to point out is that with this experiment and with the other experiments that I'll be describing, every individual spider was only ever tested once. So, you know, for that spider, it was always encountering a novel task to solve. And yet, in spite of that, what we were finding was very clearly the spiders were choosing the correct walkway significantly more often than the incorrect walkway. Then...
Well, why did you decide not to have them do multiple trials?
We were just interested in whether this is an innate capacity by these spiders, you know, by not training the spiders, whether they actually can do this on their first attempt. I mean, we were also finding, when we looked at the data for each of the 15 species, they were consistently choosing the correct walkway.
So just a little follow-up. So sure. These are... born in the lab, you know that they've got no...
Correct. Yeah, that's what we generally do with these experiments. We breed them in the lab in the hundreds or even the thousands, and we can carefully control what the spider has eaten beforehand, and these spiders have never taken one of these detours before. So once we saw that, we were interested in not just whether they choose the correct walkway, but whether they also complete that walkway. And again, we were seeing that they were consistently completing the correct walkway more often. Now, each of the spiders was given a score according to how far along it had advanced along the walkway. So a score of 1 meant that the spider had simply chosen the walkway. And then a score of 4 meant that the spider had completed the walkway. And this got interesting when we looked at these scores because, when the spiders chose the correct walkway, most of them then completed that walkway. But we didn't see many spiders that chose the incorrect walkway, only 15. And of those, most of them got a score of 2. Now, what this means is that those spiders walked up this segment of the incorrect walkway and then stopped there. Now, we don't know for sure, but yeah, we'd need to run a different experiment, but it was suggesting to us that perhaps the spider was not in the location it had expected to be in. What we do know is that here we have 15 different species. They consistently chose and completed the correct walkway more often. And although we don't know whether we were seeing evidence of expectancy violation in this context, we have been interested in exploring this using Portia, and sort of reminds us of the work that's been done with human infants, where you show the infant an object such as a small toy, you hide that object behind a screen, and then when you lift the screen again, if the infant then encounters a different sort of object, it will stare at that object for longer than if the object had just remained the same. And we have been exploring this, as I said, with Portia. And one of the ways we've been doing this has been in the context of numerical cognition. Now, in Portia africana's habitat, it will encounter this species of Argyroides. It's upside down and it's facing to the right there. This spider is typically found in aggregations. So what we did was we made lures using these spiders, and then we presented them to Portia in groups of 1 to 4. And what we were interested in this case was whether Portia was actually disinclined to complete a detouring task if it encountered a number of spiders that it didn't expect to see. Okay, so to explain this, the apparatus consisted of a pathway. The pathway included 2 adjacent towers. Now, attached to one of these towers was a horizontal ramp which the spider could walk across to reach the lures in the scene. The spider began the trial on top of this tower. From the tower, it could view the lures, but again, the distance was too far for the spider to reach by leaping, and again, the apparatus was sitting in a pan of water. So, in order to reach the prey, the spider first needed to walk down from this tower. Then, when it reached this point, it could either keep going straight to exit the apparatus, or it could just continue along this detouring path. But when the spider reached this point, it couldn't view the lures, and because the walls of this tower were opaque. And as I've already alluded to, Portia does everything slowly, but it does do some things quickly. But when we're observing them, they can be pretty slow. So it was actually given 3 minutes to walk up this tower, which was very convenient for us. This gave us enough time to change the number of lures in the scene. So for instance, here we changed the number from 4 to 2 lures, and what we were interested in was what happened when Portia reached the top of this tower and could view a different scene for the first time. There were 2 things we were interested in. First of all, how long it actually took Portia to start stepping onto the ramp. They were given 5 minutes to do that. And secondly, we were interested in how many spiders actually completely crossed that ramp in order to reach the lures. Now, one thing about this work is that it didn't actually matter whether the spiders saw the larger number of prey at the start of the trial or at the end of the trial. Either direction, we saw very similar findings. And so for the purposes of this talk, the data are pulled. What we were finding is that when the spiders were in the experimental trials in which the number changed, they were significantly slower to start stepping onto the ramp as opposed to those in the control trials where the number did not change when they were presented with 1 versus 2 prey, 1 versus 3 prey, 1 versus 4 prey, 2 versus 3 prey, and 2 versus 4 prey, but not 3 versus 4 prey. Similarly, when we looked at the number of spiders that had completely crossed that ramp, we saw that significantly fewer did so in the experimental trials where the number changed, as opposed to those in the control trials where the number did not change when they were presented with 1 versus 2 prey, 1 versus 3 prey, 1 versus 4 prey, 2 versus 3 prey, and 2 versus 4 prey, but again, not when they were presented with 3 versus 4 prey. Now, if we kept the number of prey the same, but simply changed how those prey were arranged during the trial, we saw no evidence of Portia hesitating or being disinclined to cross the ramp. And likewise, if we kept the number the same, but changed the size of the prey during the trial, we saw no evidence of Portia hesitating or being disinclined to cross the ramp. This was suggesting to us that Portia was paying attention to the prey number and not just the amount of prey stuff. Just as a very brief comparison, I mean, there has been very little done looking at numerical cognition with a spider. So I just thought it might be of interest to compare with another study. What these researchers did was they used Nephila, an orb web spider. Now what happens is that when prey land on Nephila's web, it will wrap that prey up in silk and then it will store that prey as a larder to eat at a later time. But if a predator comes along and steals the larder, Nephila will go searching for its missing larder. What these researchers did was they placed mealworms on the web and then removed those mealworms. And what they found was that when they placed a heavier mealworm on the web and then removed it, Nephila searched for longer than if a lighter mealworm had been placed and then removed. Also, what they found was that when the larders were of the same weight, but there were more mealworms within a particular larder, Nephila searched for longer if the larder had consisted of more mealworms. It's a very different study to what has been done with Portia. I mean, for one thing, we're able to take advantage of the fact that Portia can see so much better than Nephila. And also, we can take advantage of the fact that Portia seems to be sensitive to expectancy violation. What we were finding here was we were seeing expectancy violation in the context of Portia being hesitant or being disinclined to complete this task. And we were seeing how Portia was representing prey number independently of the size of the prey and independently of how the prey were arranged. There's still so much that we have to learn about this. It's still the very early stage. But so for instance, we don't know if Portia treats three or more prey as simply being many prey, or if we will find other designs in which we can see discrimination between larger numbers. Yes.
So we were talking yesterday about that sometimes they're preyed upon. Is it by these particular spiders?
They do run a risk of being preyed upon by these spiders. I mean, okay. Some spiders are more dangerous to Portia than others,
right.
But one thing to point out is how in this experiment we actually used larger juvenile Portia, and that was mainly for logistical reasons in terms of building the apparatus, because with adults the apparatus would need it to have been huge. It was made of glass as well, and so just so with that kind of prey spider, it could very well have been a risk to a juvenile Portia, because it wasn't much bigger than the prey spiders presented in this experiment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing that we have been doing more recently is looking at whether Portia even makes decisions about taking detours. So, bringing you back to this photo again. Yes, when Portia encounters a spitting spider, the back end is generally the safe end, but there are times in which Portia will encounter a spitting spider that is carrying an egg sac in her mouth parts. Now, when this female spitting spider is carrying her eggs, she's not very inclined to drop her egg sac in order to spit. So for Portia, this is a safer type of prey to encounter. When it encounters one of those spitting spiders, it's more inclined to just approach that spitting spider directly. When the spitting spider is not carrying eggs, Portia's more inclined to take the detour to approach the spitting spider from behind. So we do know that Portia will make decisions on the basis of prey safety, but what we have been looking at is whether Portia also makes decisions on the basis of avoiding contact with water. So in this experiment, the spider began on top of this tower. It could view these lures to give you a bird's eye view of the lures. They were either, again, made from dead prey spiders or from pieces of dead leaf. Again, the distance was too far for the spider to reach by leaping, and again, the apparatus was in a pan of water. So, as the spider walked down from this tower, it couldn't view the lures after leaving the tower because they were hidden behind a wall. After it left the tower, however, we weren't just interested in the spiders that just wandered around aimlessly on the platform under the tower. We were specifically interested in whether the spider did one of three things, because that had suggested to us that the spider had planned what to do after leaving the tower. So, what it could do is either attempt to go straight towards the lures by reaching that edge of the platform closest to the lures, or it could go along this walkway to reach the lures indirectly, or it could just exit the apparatus. But in half of the trials, we placed a causeway between the platform and the box containing the lures. So now, instead of having this option of reaching the lures indirectly, the spider could just reach the lures directly by crossing this causeway. Or again, it could just exit the apparatus. Now, what won't come as much of a surprise is that when Portia was presented with prey lures, it was more inclined to take some way of approaching those lures. When they were presented with the leaf pieces, none of them took the walkway. When we looked at the data only for the spiders presented with the prey lures, what we were seeing was that when the causeway was present, more inclined to take the causeway. When it wasn't present, we were seeing that more were taking that walkway to reach the lures. We couldn't, of course, make a similar comparison when they were presented with the leaf pieces because none of them took that walkway. But what we were seeing was something interesting in the context of the spiders exiting the apparatus. So when the causeway was present, they were more inclined to take the causeway, but when the causeway was absent, they were more inclined to just exit the apparatus. Now, either way, we weren't seeing very much motivation by these spiders. It seemed that they were looking for a way to exit the apparatus. By comparison, we saw no evidence to suggest that the presence or absence of the causeway had an influence on the spiders exiting the apparatus. So, yes, while Porter's on top of the tower, it could view the lures, it could see that there were either prey lures or leaf pieces, made its plan accordingly, could see that there was water in the pan. And what we were finding, yes, when they were presented with the prey lures, more inclined to take the causeway if it's present, and in general, more inclined to take a detour in order to reach prey. So I've now described a few different studies using Portia. I feel like I've only just scratched the surface here. I mean, one thing that I haven't even mentioned so far in this talk is what happens when Portia reaches the edge of the webs of some spiders. What it can do is use its 8 legs and 2 pedipalps to start plucking the silk strands of the web in ways that actually appear to be mimicking the movements of a trapped insect on the web. The resident spider goes across to the source of the signal, and you know, Portia will use trial and error to create a signal until that spider starts walking across. If the resident spider actually starts rushing across, Portia will change its plucking behavior until it seems to be calming that spider down. And when the spider gets close enough, Portia will just grab, kill, and eat that spider. But just keep in mind how very tiny these spiders are when they hatch. Again, we have a spider on my finger. My fingers are very small. These spiders basically resemble dots with 8 legs. And yet, even when Portia is such a tiny spider, and even when it's not encountered a particular type of spider before, it will still successfully use strategies to capture that spider without getting harmed. So, yes, it appears that these are innate strategies, but that does not mean that Portia is an inflexible predator. Portia needs to be flexible because of how it's targeting other predators. And so what we're arguing is that being able to pay attention to prey number, prey type, and being able to make plans are important. This is an important part of Portia's predatory strategy in order to survive. So yes, in Kenya, we do have these big, amazing predators. They've got wonderful predatory strategies. But I hope that with this talk, you'll appreciate that in Kenya, we do have much smaller predators that I would argue are just as exciting. They've got such wonderful strategies, but with a very important difference, because they're using brains that would comfortably fit on pinheads. So before I finish, I'd like to briefly mention a few of my colleagues who I've worked with over the years. Again, here's Professor Robert Jackson. He's been an incredible source of inspiration and encouragement. My work simply wouldn't be possible without Robert. He's the person who took me to Kenya in the first place. This is Stephen Alowich, who is our head technician in Kenya. And again, without Stephen, this work wouldn't be possible. He runs the lab. He is so good at finding the spiders that we need. He's got a very good eye for finding the spiders. He looks after the spiders. Each spider needs its own cage, otherwise they run the risk of getting eaten. He helps with designing and building the apparatus. So Stephen's a very important part of our team. I want to mention other colleagues and sources of funding and various institutions. It's quite, you know, international research here. And also want to thank you all again for coming along. I very much appreciate it. And whether there are any further questions that you'd like to ask.
Say something more about why number is important.
Yeah. The thing is that in Portia's habitat, it can encounter various spiders in the same location. So, for instance, I see these great big spider webs outside of houses, and yeah, it'll be occupied by the resident spider. The webs will capture insects, and the webs will be raided by other spiders to steal the prey. And then you'll see other Portia, they're lurking around the webs, they'll go into these webs, they will eat the spidery thieves. And so for one individual Portia, it is not just encountering insects, but other spiders, other Portia. And there's actually work that hasn't yet been published. We need to be working on this, showing that Portia also, besides paying attention to number of prey, also pays attention to other Portia individuals in the same scene. So there's various things that Portia needs to pay attention to, but the thing is that, you know, although it surprises some people that Portia doesn't show sort of like a preference for going towards more spiders than fewer spiders, thing is that Portia will generally eat a spider at a time. And so, yeah, so it didn't seem to matter either way. Now, although this is speculation, if there is a change in number, it could be suggesting to Portia, well, where has the other spider gone? Is it hiding under the ramp? So, yeah, I mean, yes.
A follow-up of that. So it looks like in all of those trials, you've increased the number. Did you also try, like, decreasing?
Yes. Yeah. So, for instance, instead of having 4 prey at the start and then 2 prey at the end, we would have 2 prey at the start and 4 prey at the end, and we didn't see a difference either direction.
Yeah. So it's kind of following like Weber's law, right? Like the Jandy of...
Yeah, it's pretty cool how they don't seem to be distinguishing between 3 and 4.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah.
But 1 and 2.
Yes.
And but you said size didn't make a difference. So when
we didn't see in that context.
But
there might be a GND there too, right?
Pardon?
There might be a GND there too, right?
Like, no, but one would think that was a particularly pertinent issue for Portia to be attentive to.
Bigger
Portia would be more of a threat than a smaller one.
I mean, generally they don't eat prey larger than themselves.
Right.
And
right.
But a
larger would be a threat to them.
Sorry?
A larger Porsche would be a threat to the individual.
To the
one
prey
subject.
Spider.
To the subject.
You meant. To the subject, to your subject.
Right.
Yeah.
Huh. Are there examples of, because I think you remember, I think you said Porsche is cannibalistic, but are
yes.
there examples of other jumping spiders that maybe, that show like cooperative behaviors, if maybe for hunting, that you're aware of?
Yes. Yeah. So that's not the sort of work that I've
sure.
been doing, but yeah, it's definitely a lot of interest in that kind of behavior.
So when Porsche is traveling,
mm-hmm.
and again, I'm just intrigued by the slowness
uh-huh.
of the pace.
Yeah.
So does that say anything about when, quote unquote, decisions are made?
Mm-hmm.
If Porsche has plotted a route,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to finding its way as it proceeds, wouldn't it make sense to, and since Porsche is capable of speedy movement,
mm-hmm.
wouldn't it be advantageous to simply get to where you need to go, where the prey is located?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you wouldn't have this laborious, slow-paced procedure,
mm-hmm.
you know, path. You would get there quickly.
Yeah.
So any thoughts as to what's going on
yeah.
there? Or is Porsche having to calculate, you know, as it's going along, and sort of make decisions point
mm.
to point, as does that
mm.
does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, it does. And I mean, yeah, again, purely speculation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we think that Porsche is being so slow in general because of being a spider predator. But it is a very good point why they don't just get there more quickly. The thing is that, for instance, with the Phidippus jumping spiders I mentioned at the start of this talk, they are quicker predators. I mean, and of course, insects could fly away, but generally other spiders are pretty much staying in the same location.
Yeah, built the web, right? It's
yeah,
hanging
and they have, yeah. But in saying that, it's not out of the question, like it's not completely unusual, for instance, for the prey spiders to have been removed from that apparatus, as I described, because, you know, the spiders could have moved a little bit away, but even still, we generally see a lot of caution by Porsche. It is a very unusual spider.
Again, I can appreciate the issue of caution,
mm.
but that might be more likely the closer you get.
And that's why, the thing is that, for instance, in that first detouring experiment I described with Porsche Africana, it wasn't of interest to time how long it took Porsche to go down the tower and along the walkway. And we didn't see any significant difference in the timing of that. Didn't matter how many spiders it had seen at the start of the trial. It was once they had reached the top of the tower when we did start seeing interesting things. Yeah.
So for the experiment where you either have the direct pathway or not,
mm-hmm.
do you think if you waited until after the spider got down
mm-hmm.
and then placed the pathway, if it has a flexible enough idea of its plan that it would then go directly rather than indirectly, or do you think it makes its plan and that's what it's going to do?
Yes, that would be very interesting to look at, and we haven't done it. But one of the criteria for this experiment was that when the spider had left the tower, it directly did one of those three things.
Sure.
And yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. I mean, There would have been, it would be quite a different sort of experiment to design that, because Portia would see the causeway being moved in that location, but very good thing to consider for sure. Yeah, thank you.
In terms of natural history stuff, so Portia tackles other spiders, some of which are probably venomous as well.
Yes.
How is it that Portia is successful? What is it about the fighting or attack strategies of Portia that makes it a successful predator of other spiders?
It's the fact that Portia uses such a wide variety of strategies. I mean, for instance, in Queensland, Australia, Portia fimbriata preys on a particular jumping spider called Jacksonoides. And when Portia can smell Jacksonoides, it will start leaping up in the air, and Jacksonoides, being another jumping spider, it sees that movement, it turns to the source of this movement. Portia sees the movement of Jacksonoides, and then as it goes down to the ground, it can then see where to go to get its prey. I mean, that's just one example. When preying on a web-building spider, there's various strategies that Portia uses, as I mentioned, the aggressive mimicry. But there are other instances in when Portia approaches a web and it can't just make these web signals because the web is too big, or the spider is particularly dangerous if it rushes over, for instance. And so just one strategy that Portia will use is it will actually wait at the edge of the web, and then if there's a gust of wind, it will start stepping onto the web. And then when the wind stops, Portia stops. And it continues on and on. And this can take hours. Apparently it can even take more than a day for Portia to do this. Now, what Portia looks for on this web is, say, a leaf on the web. And so Portia just edges closer to this web, to the leaf. And then once on the leaf, it will wait until the spider gets close enough, and then it will just kill its prey. You know, it needed to have that substrate on the web in order to leap onto the prey, because the web was too big to leap from the edge of the web.
That's interesting. Don't those web building spiders excise leaves? Because leaves, of course, are like wind. You know, it captures the wind and makes the web all, and destroys the web sometimes, right? I mean, if there's violent enough wind, a leaf in the web destroys it. So the spider will typically come and cut out the leaf and then rebuild that portion of the web. Yes.
Yeah,
so,
I mean,
so it's interesting that portion might take, you know, I don't know whether it's a advantageous in that sense. You know, the web owner approaches the leaf.
Well, so you were talking about some of the root finding stuff as being innate, and you're talking about a lot of different highly specific strategies here. I mean, what role do you think learning plays in this? Or is it, I mean, it just seems like that arsenal of strategies that are so specific seems hard to evolve to me. But what role do you think learning plays?
I mean, as I mentioned, we specifically use the spiders that have never encountered these situations before, and so it's not learned behavior. I mean. The problem is that these experiments take so long to run that we haven't...
You're talking about the... Sort
Just the basic ability to find your way around.
Right.
Yeah.
That's your testing with respect to unlearned abilities. But all of what you just described in terms of these remarkable different hunting strategies mm-hmm. that vary according to the prey,
mm-hmm.
that could there might, I know you just would have to speculate, but
yeah.
might there be a learned component to that?
Well, I mean, for instance, with the when Portia makes the signals on the web and how it uses trial and error in that mm-hmm. respect, and it has to adjust that signal mm-hmm. according to its prey.
I'm wondering how much of this, all of these behaviors, is that due more to like a variation across like different members of the species, or mm. is it like it, does one one organism have all of these different behaviors?
Well,
yeah.
You would be amazed, because one spider can do it all.
Really?
Yeah, and it can very quickly adjust. Apparently,
mm-hmm.
to change its strategy if it needs to, it can do it in one day.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
I mean, that's something right there, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Super interesting.
Thank you.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much.